Hello, Daniel.
Hello, David.
It's the day after. We are talking on the day after the Annapolis conference opened, although I think we'll be broadcast a day or two later. But let's give viewers perhaps some introduction as to why the two of us have been convened to speak about this.
Well, on my side, and it's a pleasure to be here with you, Daniel Levy, and well, last time this kind of thing was taking place, which is all of 7 years ago, I was not on the outside commenting. I was on the inside as an Israeli negotiator in the Taba negotiations, which happened in 2001, and during the period of then Prime Minister Ehud Barak, he's the defense minister today, then Prime Minister Ehud Barak's premiership. I worked as an advisor in the PM's office and have been in official and often unofficial think tank roles in Israel for the better part of over a decade.
And you have an academic background in these issues as well.
I do, yes, but mostly through my education in the UK. I moved to Israel, what we call Made Aliyah, from the UK in 1991 and, until I came to Washington a year ago, and I'm now here with the New America and Century Foundations. I was doing that.
My background is I don't have an academic background in Middle East issues. I worked for President Bush as a speechwriter in 2001 and 2002. I've written a lot about those experiences and some of the decisions that were made at that time, both in books and in journalism. I suppose the reason that that I was invited is that I've been very skeptical of the prospects for Annapolis and very doubtful about this whole attempt to negotiate a solution to the problems of the Middle East. I think that negotiations work when the parties both share an interest in achieving a peace. They fail when they are used as a substitute for other forms of for the very desired result of conflict in the first place. So I suppose we have opposing views, and that's why we've been brought together.
Right.
Well, maybe we should begin by talking about how we assess what has happened so far, how things look in these early hours of the Annapolis events, and what we expect to happen in the very short term.
Well, I think that Olmert and Abbas, that the respective leaders on the Israeli and Palestinian side, tried to rise to the occasion yesterday. I think they both gave speeches that were in some way difficult domestically for each of them to give, quite uplifting. I have to say, having read some of the Israeli press this morning, they share your skepticism, David, and a sense of a good show taking place yesterday in Annapolis. You can tick the boxes that the president gave his commitment. You had all the attendees that you wanted to have there, 16 Arab states, I believe it was. As I said, uplifting speeches, and you even got a joint statement. What hasn't fooled anyone is that this was rather bereft of content and substance. And that joint statement that I just referred to is 437 words that say very little. And I think, you know, people now ask, well, what changes? Are there serious negotiations? And do things look different on the ground? And the rubber hitting the road on those issues will probably happen sooner rather than later.
Yes. Do you sense that the parties, and I don't just mean these two wounded political leaders, Mr. President Abbas, but the actual parties, the states, and the people who the states represent, that they have a will to make a peace that can be in any way stable and sustainable?
I think that there is a stable and sustainable peace to be made, and maybe we'll talk about that. Do the people have a will? This hasn't been a people-driven thing so far. I think what you have on both sides, to be honest, is quite a lot of fatigue, which can be, I think at least, a harbinger of a willingness to say, okay, yes, we'll go along with something different. What you're not seeing is a people-driven process where Olmert came here because Israelis were demanding, we want a prime minister who's going to leave the territories, go back to the 67 borders and make peace with the Palestinians, or a Palestinian public that was saying the same. I think that's not the case. What you see on the Israeli side, and it's largely a mirror reflection on the Palestinian side, is distrust of the other side, lack of belief in the intentions of the other side, and yet a willingness, when polled also, to do what's considered necessary to get a two-state solution on paper, at least.
Mm-hmm. You were there when the parties at least seemed to come closer to a settlement than ever happened before. Why do you think that failed, and do you see any prospects that this time that things will be different and better?
It's interesting how you phrased it, because the narrative is that has taken root in the last 7 years is there was no deal to be had, we were still sufficiently far apart for a deal to not be reachable, and of course then it descended into violence. The sense being in the room was that we were really rather closer than that. Difficult decisions on both sides, obviously. The thing that I often think about is that we need a good choreographer. Somehow we have appalling choreography, that when there's an Israeli side that kind of feels it can go a certain way, you don't have that on the Palestinian side, and sometimes it's the opposite way around. When you have a Palestinian side that's kind of ready, maybe you don't have an Israeli side, and maybe we've lacked the external impetus to get there. And so my tendency, David, is to focus and emphasize more the getting the choreography right, rather than it's because it can't be done. I don't know whether you see that differently.
I see it entirely differently.
Let's hear.
I think conflicts are very difficult to sustain. Peace may not be the normal state of mankind, but the absence of conflict is. Conflict is expensive. Conflict is damaging. Conflict has to be constantly mobilized. And you see in a democratic polity like Israel just how hard it is to persuade people to continue to make the kind of sacrifice that's necessary to sustain even a national defense, let alone the kind of aggression against Israel that you've seen from the opposite side of the line for now 6 decades. So I don't think you need to be a very expert choreographer to bring together parties that make peace. I mean, expert negotiators get a somewhat better deal under the circumstances, they get a somewhat worse deal, but when sides have fought themselves to exhaustion, they're exhausted and the conflict ends and peace tends to come. If that does not happen, the conflict continues, and in particular if one side, in this case the Arab side, and the subset of it we call the Palestinian side, seems utterly unwilling to accept a permanent settlement with the opposite, I think you have to think that the crucial piece that is missing is the will to peace. I think that there is often a conceit that the Americans have, the British, these outside negotiators, you can somehow... That the parties just don't know how to do it. That you need to trick them into it. You need to lead them to it. They both want to go to the same place, but there's a kind of protocol, an etiquette problem, or a psychological problem. Frankly, I think a lot of the ideas behind the peace processes we've seen in the Middle East come from the world of family counseling, quite literally, where the problem is to get parties who basically love each other to overcome the obstacles and difficulties and bring them together and have a resolution. I just don't see that as the case at all. I think the reason your negotiations fail, now when I say that, I'm not your personal, and I don't blame anybody there for the failure, was you brought together the most dovish Israeli government we've ever seen, with the Palestinians at a time when everyone believed that the Palestinians wanted some kind of settlement, at the behest of maybe the most persuasive American president we've ever had, against the background of the most favorable geopolitical situation that there has ever been, where without the Soviet Union, without the rise of Iranian power, as we've seen it since 2003, there was no outside power that had its own interest in sustaining or exacerbating or inflaming this conflict, and it all still failed.
And you're putting it down to Palestinian obstructionism and rejectionism?
I'm saying that there's something about the structure of the Arab state system, and in particular of the Palestinian polity, that makes peace dangerous and unacceptable to them. And they can't do it.
Now, when Aaron Miller turns around and says, we as the Americans acted as Israel's lawyer. And he basically says, when American proposals were put on the table, you scratch beneath the surface and they didn't have the stars and stripes there. They had the blue and white of the Israeli flag. And when you have a history in which Ehud Barak, the then Israeli prime minister, began a negotiation in the 60% range, went up to 70%, 82, 91, and Ottawa only came into the arena of something that was a realistic offer, you're saying that none of that matters and that this was something to do with the Arab state system and something to do with the Palestinian incapacity to come to terms with Israel? I just want to make sure I understand.
Arafat waited, and he decided he had more to lose from an agreement than to gain.
But you're saying a real proposal was on the table, because as someone who's in the room, we're not sure.
I mean, I do believe that, but that's not essential to my argument. Because what people always treat the Palestinians in this case as if they're mutes, as if all they can do is nod their heads yes or shake their heads no. They didn't like the offer. They could have made an offer.
As someone who was there, I can tell you, I wasn't sitting with a bunch of mutants. We were doing serious drafting. In Taba, what happened is the Israeli prime minister... I mean, let's look at the history of it. You go to Camp David at Ehud Barak's behest. Clinton goes along with what Barak asked for. Many people said, look, are they ready? Do you have the preliminary negotiations in place? The Palestinians had to be convinced to go there because they said, this is a risky venture. Let's make sure we're far enough down the line. You go there, no serious proposal on the table. Only 6 months later, 1 month before he leaves office, does President Clinton put out the parameters. And then you have actually a very serious negotiation, but it's a negotiation which the Israeli prime minister calls off because he's about to face elections which he then loses. So it's difficult for me to align the history of it with the analysis there.
You know, it reminds me a little bit. If the parties want to get to a settlement, if both parties do, it is not difficult to keep all those things you described would not have been obstacles to keeping the process going. And the Palestinians had every opportunity to say, we want to keep talking. They chose the crucial datum in all this is that they chose war.
In October 2000, they started
a fight. And when you that event is the single most important event of the whole process. And when you choose that recourse, that tells me a great deal about.
Let's look at two things. Let's look first of all at did they want to carry on talking. Ariel Sharon gets elected and the Palestinians say we want to carry on talking, and Ariel Sharon sets preconditions.
So the violence starts before Ariel Sharon is elected.
But the talks end. You made the point that the Palestinians didn't want to carry on talking. The talks end when Ariel Sharon
gets violence.
No, they didn't though. Let's just look at the history. Let's just get our history right, David. Late September, the violence begins, and I'll talk about the beginning of that violence. Ehud Barak, as the Israeli prime minister, continues the talks. The talks end when Ariel Sharon gets elected and he says no more talks. So you just claim that the Palestinians didn't want to carry on talking. I'm afraid that isn't what happened. Sorry. As to the beginning of the violence begins when Ariel Sharon visits the Temple Mount and the Palestinians turn to the Israeli leadership and they said, we don't think we can control this. This is an act of unprecedented provocation. We can argue about whether that's the case or not. What then happens is, and this is my reading, the Israeli head of police in Jerusalem takes a stone on the face. He's okay, but his troops respond heavily. There are Palestinian deaths. The IDF has a plan for what to do when this breaks out, very well planned. But what you have is scores of Palestinian casualties and deaths in the first few days. It's a very one-sided affair, and then it deteriorates into an ongoing intifada. The violence was not unidirectional here.
No, look, the Israelis fought back as they did in 1996 when Arafat had previously resorted to violence. But I think there are very few people who would take the view that what happened on the Temple Mount was a spontaneous upsurge of Palestinian public opinion. What I think most...
The Mitchell Commission actually took that view. There was a commission, an international commission, that was brought in to say what happened and how do we stop it. And the Mitchell Commission did not come out on the side of the argument that said the Palestinians were just waiting for a moment to start a violent intifada. So the one internationally sanctioned but non-partisan group that was asked to look into this drew a very particular conclusion.
Yes, but the majority, it may be that if you get a number of commissioners headed by a former U.S. senator whose top priority is to get the talks going again, that they may come up with that verdict. But the majority, as you know well, I don't know if this is, and maybe you don't share this view, but historians who have looked at that have said, you know, that looks exactly like what happened in 1996. That looks like the deployment of violence as a tactic. Well, look, as you say, the Palestinians continue to they may have regarded that as a legitimate tactic. But if you're going to use violence as a tactic to get better terms, you better win. And what happened, of course, was that they lost. And so the terms naturally deteriorated, as terms do when you resort to violence and the judgment of the war goes against you.
You know, I mean, we can talk about the particularities of history, and it may or may not be interesting. I actually think, for me at least, to frame this, one needs to go to a different place. Because the working assumption here is that there was somehow not a violence inherent in the occupation. And this is where I think that somehow we've all missed the boat of what this conflict is about. And you've said, well, if they want to end it, they can. I think there's a magic word here, and it's 1967. To me, and this is where we might disagree, this is all about ending the occupation, and every day the occupation is a form of violence. So you're saying the Palestinians began a certain type of violence in September of 2000, and I think that violence was wrong, and I was living through it. But it's very difficult to be honest with oneself and pretend that the occupation is not an ongoing, daily form of violence against the Palestinians.
So it's your view that Israel and its neighbors were in a state of peace in May of 1967?
Well, they weren't in a state of peace, but it was a very different kind of conflict to what it was today.
What was the conflict about in May of 67?
Well, I think the conflict then was more about Israel getting to a recognition of its existence. But I think, as you well know, David, there were ongoing Israeli cross-border raids. It wasn't like we were pussycats at any time. We have a nice historical narrative. Every nation has a historical narrative.
When did the dispute, as it existed in May of 67, get settled? When was the moment where Israel's neighbor said, "Okay, well, we accept that you have a right not to be killed"? But now we're arguing about your borders. When did that moment occur?
When do you think it occurred?
I don't think it has occurred.
I would argue that it occurred, if it had to occur, at any time, because many historians I'm saying that if it ever hadn't been the case, because many historians now look back at 67 and say that the Khartoum conference, which is remembered as the Arabs all saying no, no, no to anything with Israel, was actually an opening ploy in a negotiation, and the messages that were sent were very different messages. What you can say, and what I think is it would be strange to ignore, is that first of all you have an Israeli peace with Egypt. That peace is ending the occupation of the Sinai and withdrawing the settlements from the Sinai. You then have an Israeli peace with Jordan as we move forward with the Palestinians. Since 1988, the Palestinians have accepted a two-state solution. In 1991, all the Arab states come to Madrid because they say, if you're going to have a peace process, we're ready to be on board. And in 2002, it's formalized. The Arabs say full comprehensive peace for full normal relations. I think that Israel has at times made real moves towards peace, but what I haven't heard is the word 67. That's what I think this is about, and I think yesterday at the Annapolis conference and 5 years ago with the Arab Initiative, it was put out there, this Arab recognition of Israel, normal relations, acceptance of Israel in the context of Israel no longer being an occupying power. I think it's difficult. Sometimes I think that amongst the pro-Israel community, we all have this sense of saying, okay, we've gotten to yes. I think we have gotten to yes with the Arab states, but somehow it's not good enough. It's like you have an argument in a family, and you're arguing for years and years and years, and then someone says, you know what, I accept it. And you say, no, 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 but I want you to not only accept it, I want you to accept what's behind it as well. And why do we need that? We've gotten to yes with the Arab states. That's where we are. Now it's up to us to say, okay, we accept your yes.
I think you confirmed a complaint I registered at the beginning, which is too much of this is drawn from the realm of family therapy. I think it's, I often find it very instructive to compare what has happened, what happens between Israel and its neighbors, to the conflict between India and Pakistan, which is many people describe as the most dangerous conflict in the world, nuclear weapons on both sides. And there are questions there of exactly where the borders are, who gets how much of Kashmir, where does it belong. There has never been a moment, though, where either state has questioned the legitimacy of the existence of the other state, and where either state has said that the object of the conflict is the extinction of the other. And that the that normally, in normal state-to-state relations, you do not bargain for your right not to be annihilated. That is a precondition. You know, it's just an assumption. States have a right.
I think that's an obfuscation, David. There is a state of India. There is a state of Pakistan. There's no state of Palestine. And this isn't state to state because Israel hasn't ended the occupation, because there's no Palestine there.
Well, there wasn't, as you said, there was all those states. If that were true, I mean, this is why the 1967 argument really doesn't wash. There should have been peace from 1948 to 1967, when the West Bank and Gaza were not occupied by Israel.
Well, you know what the conditions were. Okay, let's go there. What happens in 1947? In 1947, 60 years ago this week, by coincidence, the United Nations suggests a partition plan. 55% of mandatory Palestine to a Jewish state, 45% for a Palestinian Arab state. At the end of the 48-49 independence war, Israel is in control of 78%. Now, you can say that the Palestinians rejected the partition in 1947, but Israel has aggrandized another 23% of territory. And I think where we've segued from then until now is that the Arab position is, we accept you on 78%. We're not asking you to go back to 55% according to international legality and the UN mandate. I think that's an achievement for Israel. I think the question that we as Israelis now are fighting over and are grappling with, and it's really not easy, I don't want to pretend that this is easy for Israelis, is do we say yes to 78%? That's what we're being offered. Or are we going to try and fight and carry this on in order to get to 80, 81, 83%?
Well, that
I don't hear the rejectionism that you hear. I don't hear from the Arab world. And I think it's very difficult to look at yesterday's photos in the 16 Arab states and claim that that's still where we are.
I think that story, which does, I'll then link back to the present, I think that does sort of suggest that one of the reasons why this conflict continues in the way that it does is that we've had a series of wars. And at the end of each war, the loser says, and it's been the Arab side that has been the loser, we want, okay, now we'll take what we had before we started the last war. That the idea is these wars are to be without consequences. So there was a deal on the table in 47. The Arab side said no. They launched a war. They lost. They find themselves in a worse position at the end of that war. And they said, we don't accept this position. We want to go back to where we were before. Ditto in 67.
The Arab state started the war in 67, David?
They provoked it.
I kind of remember a preemptive Israeli strike. Maybe I'm wrong.
They provoked it by violating the terms of 1956.
But again, there was a preemptive strike by Israel.
Yes, there was a first strike by Israel after the Egyptians violated the armistice that had ended the conflict, the hostilities in 1956. You know this. I mean,
you also know who started the war.
Yes, but because there's a direct threat to the existence of the state.
Okay, you know who started the war.
When you violate an armistice, that starts the clock toward a conflict.
But when you violate international law every day, that's fine. When you put a civilian settler population in occupied territory, that's fine.
Here we are if the Israelis now after 67, the Arabs say we want the terms we had before 67. Today, at Annapolis, we have Arabs saying, okay, well, Yasser Arafat started this war in 2000. It ended very
so you
bad.
Claim?
I claim. I would say probably most people who've looked at the record would agree. Not all, but most.
I think most of the people that an American audience is exposed to, yes, but your exposure is to a very limited set of analysts.
Who say so? There are people who say that Yasser Arafat did not start that war.
Well, I'm saying that the Mitchell Commission did not come out with the finding, and this was the only internationally authorized non-partisan assessment of this. The Mitchell Commission did not come out with that finding, and I think it's very important to put that out there.
All right. Well, and we can each then put the amount of stock we put in that particular report. And
right. But I kind of find internationally mandated rather than American historians.
We can each decide, and viewers can decide for themselves as well, which right. account they find most credible, and how the series of suicide bombings that happened, just another series of tragic accidents.
Well, let's remember. Okay, you've gone suicide bombings. Let's go there, David. The first Palestinian use of a suicide bombing is after, and I condemn suicide bombings. I think they're terrible. They're a disgrace, and they're the disaster for the Palestinian people. But let's not pretend that things exist in a bubble. In 1994, there is the attack at the Hebron Tomb of the Patriarchs. Until that moment, there has been no Palestinian use of suicide bombings against Israeli civilians. By the way, Israelis used certain bombings when we were trying to gain our own liberation before the declaration of the State of Israel. That's when the suicide bombings first started. There is a hiatus. The suicide bombings end. Israel, during a period of quiet, then assassinates, admittedly a terrorist, the guy known as the engineer in Gaza. Then you have a spate of suicide bombings. The suicide bombings during the current Intifada don't begin in September of 2000. They begin several months after the Intifada started. When do they begin? They begin after Israel carries out assassination policies, targeted killings. So again, I just think that if you see this outside of a historical context, then you can't understand it. So I've closed my suicide bombing parenthesis.
Well, I think there's a line between understanding and condoning, understanding and excusing.
But no, I'm saying an understanding of the historical context.
Whatever you think of the morality of it,
Well, you know what I think of the morality of it. It's disgusting.
The justification for it. The fact is, it was tried. It was tried, and it was defeated. I wish I could say, as an Israeli, with great confidence,
that suicide bombings have been defeated. That's not how we feel in Israel still.
Well, they've been contained by the wall. And what happens after each one of these things is that the defeated side says, we want the same terms we had before. And that's obviously not the way international conflicts proceed. And I think that's one of the reasons why, and to take us back to the present day, why we're going to find the Annapolis Conference going to end in the same dismal way that approaches have ended before. The attitudes that would prevail in any country, including Israel, any country, after the experiences of 2000 to 2005, are going to be very different than the attitudes that prevailed in the middle 1990s. In the middle 1990s, there was a lot of hope that, and I shared it, by the way, that Israel and I feel foolish about that, but I did, that Israel and its neighbors were on their way to something like a normal neighborly relations, maybe not the intimacy of the European Union, although Shimon Peres hoped for that, but normal neighborly relations, a true state of peace. I would be very surprised if there are very many people in Israel who believe that today. And that is the consequence of the decisions that were made in 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003 by the Palestinians to maintain a conflict. That conflict ended in defeat for them. And it ended in changing the attitudes of the Israeli side. So what I think we're going to find is that while the expectations of the Palestinians today are exactly what they were, at least in 2000, the willingness of the Israelis to make concessions is going to be very, very different. And I think the willingness of American public opinion to put pressure on Israel to make greater concessions, is also going to be very limited. Under those circumstances, I think it's going to be very hard to succeed, especially with the Arab neighbors saying, well, we're here as the audience. We're here to applaud, to ratify. If anyone else goes first, maybe we won't object. But in the absence of a Sadat-like figure in Saudi Arabia or some other place to say, we're going to take the lead, and we are going to make proposals that are real proposals and acceptable proposals. And by the way, they do not end with the acceptance of the right of the state to non-annihilation. That's the beginning of the conversation. That's not the end point.
Let me address each of those in turn with, if you'll allow me, David.
Please.
The first is 4 points. The first one is you absolutely describe with accuracy the situation in Israel. How do you think the Israelis feel after 2000, 2001, 2003, compared to how they felt in the 90s? I agree. I sometimes feel it's almost pathetic to have to remind people, and the Palestinians, under occupation, settlements expanding, 532 checkpoints according to the last World Bank report to freedom of movement. So there's always this, well, how do you think the Israelis feel? And of course that's how I feel. But where do I live? On a different planet? No, I live next to the Palestinians. So let's just remember that they're also there, and apparently they're not having an absolutely happy-clappy time of things at the moment. The second point you make is wanting to go back to the starting point from the last conflict each time from the Palestinian side in terms of their demands. You know what? Let's say you're right on that. My question is, what does that mean for Israel? If we have pretensions to being a regional power that can continue to aggrandize territory, we can settle that territory, we can build walls against all our neighbors, we can invest a huge percentage in our national defense and not deal with our domestic problems, sweep all these other issues, not just money, but issues more important, under the carpet, send more civilians. Why not just occupy the West Bank and the Golan Heights, but let's try and win another war and be even more expansionist. We were in the past, we were in the Sinai. Someone who thinks that Israel can survive under those circumstances, I'm afraid, doesn't understand the region we're living in. And I think that's why Israel has never annexed the West Bank. Here's the flaw in your argument. You say that you can't go back to the status quo ante. Well, if not, Israel would have annexed. Formerly the West Bank, we annexed the Golan, but no one recognizes it, and every Israeli prime minister tries to find a way of talking to the Syrians to leave the Golan. Israel cannot live as an occupying regional empire-building superpower.
I absolutely agree with that, and that is why I was on board for Oslo in the 1990s.
But
I agree with you that it would be a disaster to annex the West Bank. I completely agree with that. That's the tragedy of the situation from the Israeli and Western and American point of view. That's all clear. But it's a little like that Jewish joke, if I may, about the matchmaker who goes to the tailor and says, I've got the perfect girl for your unmarriageable son. It's Lord Rothschild's daughter. And, you know, okay, well, now let's go talk to Lord Rothschild and see if he agrees. It is obvious why Israel needs a state of peace. It's not obvious, but its neighbors have never accepted that.
I think the equation is almost the exact opposite of how you depict it. Israel has never turned around and said, 67, we're there, we're ready. It's obvious to me why the Palestinians need a state of peace. Last time I checked, when I go home to Tel Aviv, I don't have to go through any checkpoints, I'm living in a booming economy, I'm living good. It's not obvious to me, actually, why the Israelis need a state of peace. It's obvious because we can't live as an occupying power. It's undermining us. It's undermining our security. But it's less obvious in a day-to-day, the nitty-gritty of life, than it is to the Palestinians. That's why I think that, unfortunately, the equation is the opposite one. Show me an Israeli leader who will say the magic word. Because I think sometimes we try and create mountain upon mountain of complexity here. Sure, it's a difficult issue. But actually, at the bottom line today, it's really rather simple. Show me an Israeli leader who'll say 67, and I'll bring you the Arab world, and I'll bring you Hamas quiescence.
Okay. I agree with you. I don't think it's a complex issue. The comparison I often make is I was born in Canada, grew up there. I do a lot of work in both countries. I pay tax in both countries. The U.S.-Canadian tax treaty, that's complicated. You should see it. I mean, just undistributed royalties in the timber industry. It's just mind-numbingly complex, and people make hundreds of dollars an hour solving these problems. This one's not so complicated. I don't think very many Israelis would accept the 67 boundaries, especially not now.
Here's the thing that makes it easy. Go on, sorry.
Another story. The Romans had this legend about that's too long a story because we're out of time.
And it doesn't sound like it's going to have rabbis in it, so I'm not going to like it.
Okay. it When the 67 boundaries may have been available to the Palestinians and the Arabs in 68, 69, 70, 71, 72, but there comes a point where you've sustained a war long enough where the deal just gets worse. And that I think is just the geopolitical fact. The deal that the Palestinians, that, and if the Palestinians cannot make up their mind that they are going to get a worse deal today than they got in September of 2000, that's going to sustain this tragedy for another generation, because they went back to the gaming table.
David, they played
the cards and they lost.
First of all, I wish there were Israelis who spoke with the confidence that you do that they lost. There ain't no great sense of victory in Israel, I can tell you. After last summer's war with Lebanon, everything that's going on, the Qassam rockets on southern Israel, we ain't kind of peacock like strutting around saying, hey, we won, we won. Why?
I understand.
Why? Because if your analysis is right, that we have to bludgeon away and bludgeon away, then this is really bad news for Israel. And here's the good news. The good news is that you're right. We don't have to go back to the 67 lines. And I think this was a very important development in the talks that did go on. Because I think much as the talks weren't successful, I at least take from this that you have far more clear-headed coming together of what the parameters of a deal are. I mean, I actually think we're in touching distance. And one of the reasons I think that is that what came out in those talks is the Palestinians turned round and said, you know what? Please don't try and convince us that any of your settlements are legitimate. They're all illegal under international law. But we also understand that there's a real world. The real world isn't that we lost the war to you. The real world isn't that you put 450,000 Israelis there and we have to swallow it. The real world is that if we want to make a deal with you, we recognize that you can't politically market to your own people moving 450,000 people. And that's how we've managed to get to a place now where you can have a border based on 67 with land swaps. And so, according to those land swaps, you don't remove the 450,000 Israelis, but you compensate the Palestinians for land elsewhere. That's what we began to talk about in Taba. That's what we developed in this Model Geneva initiative that we did. More interesting for me, that's what Ehud Olmert is talking to Abbas about. They're talking about the concept of land swaps. So there is a way to say, okay, there are realities on the ground post-67 that are irreversible, but the principle of the 78% can still be maintained. So again, yeah, thankfully, this isn't the American-Canadian tax code. It's eminently soluble.
We are drawing near to the end of our time, and we have completely ignored our proposed order of organization. But I do want to go to the last thing we raised, I would say, which is how one envisions this thing actually ending. I would say, if that were the offer on the table, if I were an Israeli prime minister and a Palestinian negotiator came to me and said, "Look, here's the deal: we begin, we accept your right to exist as a state. You will, and we've got here all your neighbors. You will be a normal part of the region if you sign on the dotted line. And the dotted line is we do, as you say, 78% of the post of the west of the Jordan lands, and we shift the borders around to accommodate it. But if that were the deal, I would take it." I don't for a moment believe that's the deal. And
David, I end this conversation wanting you to be the Prime Minister of Israel, because that's the deal. I've sat with the Palestinian negotiators. I know what their position is. And if you're going to tell me that they can't deliver, then I think there are ways around that as well, because you can create a Palestinian consensus around that position. I've been in those negotiations. I was with them just a couple of days ago again. Let's elect you as Prime Minister of Israel.
Thank you. But here's how I think the conflict will end. I think that
somehow I didn't think I was going to get the last word in.
No, I'll give you the last word. I'll take 60 seconds on this. I think that you are going to see, and I think what the reason there's so many states at Annapolis is that more and more Arabs realizing this conflict is poisoning them. That sustaining this attitude of hostility and hatred is a threat to their own societies and their own civilization. And you're going to see steady defections away, in a way that Tunisia has defected, and Morocco, other states are just going to break away, and the conflict is going to burn itself out through lack of fuel. That it is the Palestinian peace that will be the very last piece, and the deal that they're going to end up with is, unfortunately for them, and maybe unfortunately for Israel too, a rather worse peace than they could have had they signed when your man was holding the fountain pen. But you get the last word now.
they're not going to agree to that peace. The Palestinians have an incredibly weak card, weak hand, but they have one element in that, which is the ability to say no. If it's not the 78% deal, I'm convinced of this, there's no deal. Thankfully, I think the 78% deal can be done. I think those Arab defections are going to be much more minimal. I think you're right, it poisons things for the Arab states, but let's not forget, it poisons things for Israel as well. Israel needs this just as much as anyone else, and it poisons things for America. And that's maybe where my hope is, in as much as I think the extent to which America now suffers from a destabilized Middle East that America in many ways brought upon itself may lead to some more clear-headed thinking which can help resolve this. The Israelis and the Palestinians might, though, still be able to do it on their own because the deal is there to be made. Thanks a lot.
Great to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Likewise. Take care.